subject matter in the preceding podcast is entirely alleged and not admissible in a court of law. A recklessly minimal effort has been taken to change the names and details of any guilty parties. And just in case you rat bastards get any ideas, the hosts of this podcast are notorious and well-documented liars with no legally admissible credibility. This is Mama C, and you're listening to Notes from the Pen podcast. Welcome to prison, bitch.
Greetings from the prison industrial complex. You're listening to the Notes of the Pen podcast.
Notes of the Pen. Right. Give it another whirl.
I actually heard someone. Hold on. Okay. Give it another whirl. Three, two. Greetings from the prison industrial complex. You're listening to the Notes from the Pen podcast, which is an audio diary of an incarcerated human being, and I am that human being. And of course, well, I guess I could do it without a co-host. I couldn't do it without anyone because I'd just be talking into an empty phone line. But
you're going Bill Burr.
I guess I could do it without a co-host like Bill Burr, which is terrifying. The set of balls on that guy to just do a show where he's just talking directly into him. Like, I guess I have the ego to probably do just that as well. But it's much, much better with a sane counterbalance of a co-host. Someone with impeccable taste, endless heart, the best person ever. What's up, bud?
How you doing? All is well. I guess five on top, four on the bottom, for those of you that are keeping count, and it was actually reversed. It's four on top, five on the bottom. Layers of clothing today.
Right. And I might have overdressed.
T-shirt, no bottoms. So
just what is that? There's some movie where someone has, is it Dirty Dancing? Is there a scene where baby has like just a top on and no bottom or something, like underwear? I feel like that happened a lot in the 80s movies.
Yeah. So risque as it
was. No. See, here's the thing about that though.
The sexual innuendo.
They showed more nudity in the 80s in movies. Ooh, they showed more frivolous nudity in the 80s. Every single horror film you could, trust me, I was a 5-year-old pervert.
Top, yeah, for sure.
Guaranteed top. Mm-hmm. Now, they probably show more dong nowadays on TV. That's a medical term, look it up.
Yep, okay. It is. It's under D.
No. But yeah, the sun has been out of commission up at this part of the world for so long. The news has been commenting on it, has been saying, like...
You're kidding. Slow day in the newsroom. The sun is missing.
It's been weeks, and, man, it's really done a number on me. And you'd think as much as I talk about the sun and my mental health, the connection between the two on the show, I've been so focused on just singularly driven to finish the maddening process of not just writing a book in here. Four official records, which I already outlined and started in the world, but actually rewriting it and editing it in prison on a tiny fucking maddening tablet, over 112 separate JPEGs that you have to break, emails you have to break it up against because they're limited. It's been so damn all-encompassing and maddening and frustrating and just draining my spirit, but also not the story, but the process. Sure. That I haven't really paid enough attention to how much the lack of sun for the last month has really fucking just tap danced over the old cranium.
Stephen King could not have written a worse scenario.
Oh my God. You couldn't pay me. You could not pay me enough to write a novel on. So I have the larger tablet now, but I wrote it on an even smaller one, which is about the size, the screen of, smaller than the first iPhone, right?
Right.
I'm thinking the screen's maybe a little bit bigger than a pager, the size of a pager back in the day. Very small. And the third of the screen is the keyboard.
Right.
And so I've been really trying to wrap my head around classical music recently. And really? So I borrowed.
Okay.
Yeah. There's this dude, Mel, in here. And if I didn't know any better, his like eagerness to be friends would be like super alarming, right? I know we've been in another joint. He's got long, flowing, dark locks, and he's got like a almost like a Guy Fawkes deal, except a complete Guy Fawkes deal. You know, a little more filled in than that, with like a little the upturned mustache on the side. And he's so eager to like trip over himself to have exchanges, and I like him. He's cool. But it makes me either think, if I didn't know any better, I'd be like, okay, he's a predator. But I know that's not his vibe at all. That's not his, and that doesn't really happen to me in here. It almost, you know, it almost feels like either somehow he knows about the show,
what,
in the website and stuff,
okay,
or someone has told them about it. I'm just saying this is what okay. this is feels like
your
to me.
First fanboy.
Right, and I don't think that's the case. That's just,
if you
don't
count,
but that's kind of what it.
Yeah, if you don't count old, what's his name? Shit.
The first autograph I ever signed.
Hi, my name is. My name is. What was that guy?
Who's that?
Fuck! What was his name? Randy Rizzo.
Oh yeah. Well, Randy Rizzo is only interested as he, as far as it concerned him getting some sort of notoriety.
He wanted on the show.
And then he was only considering his notoriety as much as it would get him money for drugs. That's all. All he cared about. And so I get the small tablet. He gives you have to type in a password. So usually someone will write their password on a piece of paper and tuck it into like the you know, the protective case in the actual tablet. So I type it in, and I'm seeing how small this little. I'm telling you, it's a. Okay, so the keyboard is like if you put your pinky and ring finger, stack them on top of each other. That's how tall the keyboard is, right? It's your pinky and ring finger. And I'm trying to type in just the password. It's like a four-digit passcode.
You're hitting like four buttons with one push.
I cannot get it. And I go, and it makes me realize, like, I wrote a book on here. How the fuck did I?
Your fingers got.
And that was. That was the easy. I have tiny fingers. Very, you know what they say about small hands. All true. Tiny fingers.
Yep.
And
just couldn't get
a nub for. So just looking at that, I was like, how the. And then I just I can't tell you how insane it's driven me. It's like I'm on the brink of madness, trying to. Edit, re-edit, attach to stamps. So to write a novel, you want rhythm and timing and all this other stuff. And when you can only ever see 500 characters in either direction before you have to close out that message and open the next one, it's impossible to get like to really get the flow and rhythm of something. Mm-hmm. It makes it very difficult. Not to mention, when you're on a time constraint, you know, it ended up being like 112 of those individual messages to send the whole thing out, right?
Damn.
Which is roughly 108,000 words, if I had to guess, because they're a little bit less than 6,000 characters on each one. And then, so when you send it out with the financial constraints of it, too, it ends up being like, if Mama C sends me a stamp and includes one, that's 40 cents it costs her if she buys her stamps in bulk. I had to end up purchasing my own stamps to send them out, which is about the same. Once you send out, like, the first 20, right, that's what I'll send them out in chunks, I'll go back through sent mail and notice shit that I missed.
Uh-oh.
And
Uh-oh.
Go,
Oh, no.
And I can't. Now, I have the copy saved in the calendar, so I can pull it up and change it. But now I'd have to edit it, send it back out, have her plug that into the thing she's on. It's just a whole, man, I'm just stressed through the goddamn roof. I had to recruit a whole team to help me, you being right. one of them.
Yeah.
And thank God we're nearing the end of this, and you JPEG'd me, I think last night or this morning, saying you finished reading it.
I did. It was a marathon, buddy. I started Friday. I spent like 2 hours, blew through like the first 100, and then sat down yesterday from like 11 to 4-ish and got through the last 200. And I know you wanted me to just, like, read it, but that's not how my brain works. And I did, you know, I mean, I got everything down, but I was making small, tiny adjustments here or there. But I can't tell you, just people are going to lose themselves in this thing. Just lose, absolutely. You do such a fantastic job of setting the stage and the scenes, and you're right there in them. I mean, it's fantastic. I can't tell you how good it is.
Bro, thank you so much. Listen,
seriously.
When I let you read it before, very early on, it was an earlier draft. There's only been a couple people that I've let read it where I'm like, kind of like have like a little bit of bated breath, you know, to it. I really only have one negative experience with that. And I think there was a lot of other emotions and you know, subconscious shit going on with it. But with you, you read so much, right? That I was actually eager because I can't, most people, they write a bunch of other stuff. They write a bunch of short stories. They workshop the stuff. They go in, they went to school for it, and they, right. and they outline a thing, and then they workshop that, and then they do a draft, and they workshop. I couldn't do any of that. I just wrote. Nope. That's all I was doing was in your writing. And I was like, damn it. Like, I'll just figure it out as I go. That's kind of how I am. And so with you, so you read it originally, yep. and you were, you saw some potential in it, but it wasn't.
You hadn't.
It wasn't
just yet. Yeah, yeah. So I told you too, that I had started reading Jaws, and I have not read Jaws. I love that movie. It's in my top five. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And all right. I was very curious about reading it because knowing the movie and you know not now, but as a kid, like how much terror that evoked. That's hard to get across. And man, when I'm reading this novel, I'm like, he's able to do that. He's able to still evoke some sort of like terror, some fear in you through prose. And I felt the same way when I started reading your book because I have not had these kinds of experiences, that right. you've gone through. And there were times when I was like having like serious anxiety because of, you know, them trying to get money and, you know, facing possible getting kicked out of their house and things like that. And you really do get into the emotion side of it. And you did that very, very well.
Well, I appreciate it. So I'm always trying to like recalibrate, right, between how I perceive something and how it might be perceived objectively, if that's even such a thing, right?
Okay.
And so I have an appropriate. You might not. People might roll their eyes at this, depending. I've been told I have a large ego.
What?
I do try to. I am very critical of myself, probably. Especially with something like that, right? So I wrote this novella first, and I just wrote it just to write. I wrote it before I had any business writing anything, right? Like, and I just wrote from the gut, like write directly as the thoughts flowed into my head. We kind of talked about this. I don't know how much we can talk about it, so we got to be kind of limited to what we,
right. sure.
how much of the plot we cover. But basically, and I think we might have covered it before, so The Clinic is a story that revolves around this two best friends that grew up together, and they both attend this methadone clinic in Central Florida. Right? And you're pulled into this lifestyle of completely in the moment. When you're in addiction like that, for better or worse, you live in the moment because there is no past and there is no future. The only future is being dope sick, and the only past, none of it matters. It's like bridges you burn. So you're just constantly in the moment trying to make sure you're not dope sick, and you have a that's the main thing. And then everything else is secondary. A place to live, gas, cigarettes, food. That's all second, tertiary. That's all way down the line. And everything is, how do we make sure we're not dope sick? And every time you get a little bit of money, you're just adding a little time on the clock of not being
yep.
dope sick.
Yep.
And that's a very stressful, trying lifestyle. And when you put, one of the things that inspired me to kind of write the novel is I wrote the novella Rigged, and this is a prequel to that. Mm-hmm. And when I sent it away for the professor at the University of Michigan who runs the Prison Creative Arts Project, asked yep. if he could use, I think we might have talked about this, asked if he could use some of the stuff for a class where he's teaching students how to critique stuff.
Right.
I included some poetry, and then I included two chapters of Rigged. And I was like really protective of that. And it turns out I'm really protective of this whole story because it represents
yeah.
all these people who are dead in this very specific time with the yep. opioid crisis.
Yep.
And it covers that time when the opioid crisis, before the world knew about it, what was happening. This is ground zero of when all this stuff was happening from inside the trenches. And we didn't even really know what was happening because in Florida, we just assumed every place was like this, that there were, you know.
Yeah.
And since I've learned that the amount of prescription pills written for Florida at that time.
Oh, my God.
If you combine the other 49 states and multiplied it by 10, we had more in our
yep.
state.
Yep.
Pain clinics on every corner, methadone clinics, all kinds of stuff. And so I was real protective of the story. So the critiques the kid had on the poetry, I was like, yeah, okay, fine. What? And he was right about, there were good critiques. But when I got to read his critiques of the two chapters are rigged, I was very like nervous and protective.
Sure.
And so I got to find this guy because I sent the letter home. I'm going to find him one day and reach out to him and thank him because he really inspired me to keep going. But you know what I mean? Because he said, listen, this is brilliant. I've never seen, amongst other things, it wasn't real long, but he said, this is amazing. I've never seen a junkie or an addict, I think you said, portrayed as witty and problem solving,
sure.
you know, capable.
Sure.
And I said, and much like we're trying to do with the show of tearing down two-dimensional stereotypes and characters, that's what I, when he said that, and when he even questioned something else about the first-person present tense narrative I was using, he said, at first I thought you couldn't do that, but then I looked up and there are authors starting to do, I don't remember what terms he, I got to go back and look yeah. at it because it's actually, and he said, and then I saw that there are people doing this now, and basically it is accepted form. I don't remember exactly what term, because first-person present tense novels are a thing. That's how not a lot are written in that way, because they're really limited. They're the most limited narration,
mm-hmm.
because you only know what the protagonist knows at
right.
the time and can
right.
see at the time. It just inspired me that, okay, this is a thing that needs to happen because people do have this false idea of what addicts are like. So that's kind of the first thing that inspired
me. Do you think you would have fleshed out to the degree that you did had it not been for PEN America?
Well, so here's the thing. So when I tell... So
that kind of a little like... soft hand in the middle of the back kind of.
Oh, it was beautiful. Listen, so, and let me say this. PEN America was part of the little, was a single knot in a lure
mm-hmm.
that linked me up with Maddie.
Sure.
Who has the connections to Pinkman Random House, stuff like that. So, but other than that, they've left both of us hanging for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're going through some internal turmoil and stuff
sure.
like that.
But you still have that connection, so. You know,
I still have that connection, and this is what's important, though, is that I don't have enough experience to know. Like, you look around, like, when I finished writing it, I knew that it needed work, but I looked at it, and I thought, there's something here, man, and everyone who read it, there was someone reading it as I'm writing, and he kept coming back, you got any new chapters?
Because it is.
I actually wrote it.
It's like, it's not as episodic, I think, as your... maybe describing, but it is one of those things that chapter to chapter you're like, okay, you're waiting like with bated breath, like, oh my God, like I gotta see how this thing plays out. That's why it was so easy for me to sit down and blow that out in the amount of time that I did, was because you set it up in such a way that you're just, you can't put it down, guy. I mean, you just can't. I know it sounds cliche and everything, but I'm telling you, when people get this in their hand, that's it. It's over. Like, they're just, it's going to be a start to finish kind of thing.
My bunkie asked to read it. I'll let people read it occasionally when, you know, he wrote anything mm-hmm. his property. And he stayed up all night. He read a little bit and then went to bed that night. And the next day, he stayed up all night reading it. And he's like, I couldn't put it down. You haven't read Rigged, have you?
No.
Which is like the epilogue to the whole thing, and it's the counterbalance. The clinic is basically a phase of addiction before it gets tragically, unhumorously dark.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I didn't, at the end of it, because it's a funny story too.
Oh,
there's a lot of comedy.
Yeah.
And I didn't want, so it's very important. I actually had to write Maddie about this because she hasn't read Rigged either. It's very important that Rigged is an epilogue as part of this, because I wouldn't want anyone to think we're whitewashing addiction, but it happens to be based on a phase right before the downward spiral. So, and, which I hadn't seen. That's part of, you know, tearing down the two-dimensional part, is that usually in shows or books, you see the two-dimensional junkie who's like in an alley, right? But how did he get there, right? And not how did he first start dabbling, but what's that middle point like where it goes from fun to sad, right? And that's kind of the place I explore in the clinic. But along the way, I was always like self-checking and insecure about some things, right? Like, I wonder how, you know, I think it's good, and people who read it around here think it's good, but what would professionals think? You know what I mean? Does it truly stand up?
Here was the thing that I was... if I had a concern, if any, was you are a different writer now than what you were when you originally wrote it. So I was a little bit, like I said, a tiny bit concerned that when I was reading it, like picking out the parts that you originally wrote versus the way you write now, it married beautifully. It didn't matter.
No, yeah, that's what I was so...
It doesn't
matter.
Doesn't matter.
You're the first person to read that, and that's what I really needed from you was because that's true. And when I wrote, so kind of with your original question, well, let me catch up to when I sent it. So when I sent it to Maddie, who, you know, wasn't like a lackey at Penguin Random House. It was a former managing editor, the top person, right? So I sent it to her. Since then, I've learned, like, well, she told me. So when I got a hold of her, she basically was like, okay, yeah, you really have something here. Mm-hmm. And was kind of like, she explained to me, which you don't know what you don't know. And if I had went to school and I had workshop stuff, I wouldn't have written this novel because I wouldn't have presumed to be able to, which I probably wasn't. Mm. You know what I mean?
Sure, because you'd have some sort of doubt that you could.
Yes, and yes, and that, or that you're even allowed to or supposed to. But I was just ignorant to the fact, like, I can fucking do that because I've read some terrible books too, and I was like,
I could do this,
right? And so I just did it, and I really had nothing to lose. But one of the things she says, the thing that you spend years trying to develop, if you can even develop in a writer, is their voice. And she said, the voice is so loud and clear in this piece of writing. It's so unique and it's so singular as the tone and, you know, just the voice of the thing. And she said that is there in you've got that. And that's the thing I thought she was worried. She might have to okay, well, I got to help you develop your voice. And then she said, next, the characters are fully fleshed out.
Yeah.
They're super real. They're deep. They're nuanced. And so she's like, those are the two things that are the hardest thing to kind of, those are the first things you would address. So when she said that, it really, and since then I've learned, I was listening to a thing on NPR yesterday, and they had a first time novelist who was a comedian, and he wrote a memoir.
Okay.
And then he wrote a novel during quarantine, and they were asking him about it. And he kind of said the same thing, like, I figured I could do it because I wrote the character in my voice. And he said, that's the hardest thing to develop is voice. So I said, I knew this voice because I based this character on myself. So I just write from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it also felt like the universe giving me a kick in the ass when I've been kind of like, you know, this is my baby. Like, yeah. I love this thing in a way that's detached from my ego, that this thing is this representation of this time in Florida and all these people who passed away, and I use all real names in it, even if the characters aren't.
I wrote that down in my notes. I'm like, I'm recognizing, I'm not going to say them, but I recognize so many of those names because you've talked about them.
Yeah. So,
which is amazing because it's another personalization on the story itself, is that these are and were real people.
Yeah, and when you're plugging names in for stuff on the storyline, they don't have to match the person or anything. They're more of like a wink and a nod to those people. No, you know that, but I'm saying just no one else would know really, other than, you know, if it's written in the back. Like there's a scene where one of the characters hit a wall and basically, like, listen, we can't keep doing this. Mm-hmm. Like scraping mm-hmm. money together, mm-hmm. these $12 for the methadone clinic every morning.
Yep.
And they're, like, kind of going back and forth. And he's saying, how many fucking people do
Friends.
We know
yep.
that died
this year?
This year. And he, right, and he says, no, fuck that. How many friends do we know died? And he starts naming them on his thumb, his index finger, his middle finger. And he goes through and he names five of their, like, best friends that died. They're all real people of mine, that best yes. friends that have died. And he says, the best friends I've ever had relegated to enough digits to make a fist.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And yeah. And those are my little, like, winks and nods to all those people and stuff. When I had my bunkie help me retype it, I had some distance from it because I hadn't reread the thing in a while. And when he finished, I looked to make sure it was saved in the calendar properly, and I read the very end. And people read this, and everyone in prison who's read it turns to me and whispers, and they go, this really happened, didn't it? And I said, no. I mean, yes and no. No, the story arc didn't actually happen, but it's based on real situations and real people and a real vibe and real environment. But no, this people think that some of the crimes were actually committed and stuff like that, and they weren't. You know, when I sent it to Maddie mm-hmm. and she read it, she went through, like, okay, so the voice is strong, the characters are great, and so then I'm like, okay, so what do I need, like, what, because I know it's not. And she said, okay, so you don't have to listen to these because it's good as it is. We can submit it as it is if you want. Okay. But I would suggest, and this is where her brilliance comes in, because she knows these things. Mm-hmm. She says, I think you should set the hook a little earlier because you don't get any hint about the plot line or the main plot twist until, like, a third of the way in or a quarter of the way in. And so I was like, okay, oh, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And I think she's so used to dealing with creative types that I could feel that she expected some pushback. I promise this is a testament.
You did not offer it.
No, because I really am serious when I say that the story is more important than me, more important than my ego or and so whatever makes the story better. And if there's suggestions that she makes that I don't think I won't do, right? Mm-hmm. So she says, that's one. Like, see if there's a way you can set the hook a little earlier, even if it's just, like, some subtle, like, hints or clue, whatever.
Right.
And then, brilliant, I said. And the next one was, if you could develop a little more of a foil character, like an evil, you know, a villain, kind of. Because up to that point, the villain to me was the clinic itself. This, like, looming entity of bureaucratic bullshit, mm-hmm. capitalist money grab of the clinic. And there's a couple villains in it. Disney may or may not make an appearance.
Yeah.
Which became one of her larger notes where she said, listen, Penguin Random House has a partnership with Disney. So she said, you can leave it as you want, as it is.
Bush Gardens.
So we have but listen, this is Central Florida, and these the state, the area, and even these places, even Walmart, you know what I mean, are characters in the story as well.
For sure.
But that was also brilliant, and she kind of suggested one of the counselors, Ratzenberg, as a foil.
Yeah.
And I sat and I took notes and I thought about it, and then.
But what you did with that was amazing, because.
Well, this is
I'm not going to give it away.
Well, this is a testament. Well, we can talk. So this is a testament to the fact that before I wrote this, I used to hear annoying writers like myself say, well, the characters really took on a life of their own. And I always thought it was bullshit until I started writing this novel. So I don't know if I told you this. There's a major character, Nikki, mm-hmm. who kind of becomes the moral compass of the whole thing.
100%.
Was never meant to be anything. That first scene she's in, there's a drinking competition with a pig that happens impromptu. And so that first scene, when they're there, that was really all she was supposed to be in, right? But as I started writing, she started becoming a more important part, and then she ended up becoming this really major threat to it.
Really big part, yeah.
So when she mentioned, like, maybe this one counselor who's, like, just a stuffy, follow everything by the book douche, right?
Yep.
I outlined it, and then the story itself kind of gave me this other thing, and it ended up being the boy's landlord. And there's a whole thread.
Guy. I love that guy.
Whole foil thread. And that was actually, that character is completely based on my real landlord at that house that it's at, the clinic it's at. Yes, yes. Chip Vermeer. I don't think that's a real thing. But,
yeah.
But, yeah. And so those were the big, that was the big insert there, right? And it did personify, like, her advice was brilliant. And that did worry me a bit, too, because when I wrote those threads, because there's two longer, there's little setups up along the way, but then there's two longer ones
right.
where, okay, so we won't give much
also,
away without...
By the way, I wouldn't live in that house for all the money in the world. Holy shit.
You said you wouldn't?
I would not. Like, the descriptions you have of that house, I'm just like, oh... Like,
there's a way, dude.
It's like, I'm thinking like train spotting, like just worst bathroom.
It wasn't as bad as train spotting.
it didn't
have as much time
it
to
was
it
a
because
glorified dorm room.
Yes, yes, with an unfinished Florida room with no windows and it's really dark. There's washer and dryer. At the end of the fucking room,
balls
right?
on but you guys too to be able to name a fucking room in a house. My God,
a Florida room.
The only state in the nation. Oh, have you been to my Ohio room? No.
But yeah, Corey was there when I did it, and I just was drunk and just unloaded a shotgun through. They had tried to build like a wall, like a little bar area, and you could see through the little. Shelf of the bar. There was
Who tried?
Whoever owned the house. Whoever had the house before. And so I shot through that.
I'm just imagining people like showing up to your place while you're not there, just trying to make home improvements.
No, it was there. That's how that real Florida room was left unfinished. Yeah. And I blasted through the lower part of the bar area. You know, the little knee wall like there. And the lights went out. I should have shot. There were some wires that were still
did
on there.
Did it learn its
lights
lesson?
Out. Chip did. Chip did. Never ran to a nut like
Can
me
I...
ever again. But her shit was brilliant with that. And we developed. So there's a scene where. I don't know how much. I don't think we can get into it.
There's
where they kind of have to avoid. There's a scene where they have to avoid the landlord, not just evicting them.
It may not involve some sort of food product.
Butter?
Well, I wasn't going to say it.
Okay. Well, they have to. There's basically a scene where the boys have to. So the main character's name is Danny, and his best friend, childhood friend's name is Sal.
Mm-hmm.
And. Sal actually did model after one of my friends who passed away. And Sal's real charismatic and outgoing and charming. And Danny is, like, introverted, annoyed at everything. Everything annoys him.
Right.
You know, he overanalyzes everything.
Sucks at Mario Kart.
He's pretty good at fucking Mario Kart. He's pretty goddamn good at Mario Kart.
Just can't get it.
Right. That's a new one, though. That whole thread is a new one. It worked out good, and that's all real.
Yeah,
that's all real as far as like the Mario Kart princess and all that stuff. And it ended up becoming like this time capsule to like the early 2000s and stuff. And I don't. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I'm gonna wedge this in there because this was important.
Go ahead.
When I was reading this, I was not reading it in anyone. Sometimes when you're reading a book, you can hook somebody's voice into it as far as like what's playing in your head. And normally
right.
I'll pick up a character and that's kind of who I read it through.
It
was basically me reading to myself all the way until the last page. And then the weirdest fucking thing, and hand to God, the last page, it was in Bourdain's voice. It was fucking freaky.
Oh.
It was freaky. The last
page. Oh, I could see that.
The last page, he was telling me. He read the last page to me, and I was like, "What the fuck?"
That's really, really interesting.
It was crazy. I'm like all the way through, and then it was just like, I could see him doing this. Maybe that's what it was I was trying to find who would narrate this. Like, who, if there was an audiobook version of this, who would do it? And it, right at the last page.
Oh, my God.
It was crazy.
I would love to get a hold, now that they have, AI. There's enough of his voice. Right, no, I'd love to get a hold of his family and stuff and see if, because this is his type of story,
exactly.
too.
It was his inflections and the way that he brings life to things like that. And it almost made me sad, like I wanted to go back and start it over to see if it would pick back up in his voice or not. And maybe I won't do that, just as kind of like a control, but that was the best thing, was that last page, because the last page is amazing. It really is. It just
bowties. It's gut-wrenching.
Chef's kiss. Mwah. And then to have him read it on that last page, fucking forget about
it. So when you first read it, right, I didn't get, and this is beautiful, by the way, I didn't get like the, oh, my God, this is like the greatest thing I ever read from you, right? You were like, yeah, there's something there. You know what I mean? And I was like, all right.
All right, Dick.
All right, motherfucker.
I'm going back. All right. Give me my notes.
Right. Right. Which is what made, because I've done all these rewrites and honed it more, and there's a thing that happens when you're doing anything, when you get into the detail and you become too immersed in something, you kind of lose perspective of it, and it's really hard to judge how something's coming off, right? So I became way too close to it, and I would toil over a single sentence for hours and end up making it worse and not know. So no one has read it yet fully all the way through. Even Ray, as she's helping me, she read the new threads before they were inserted in there. So you're the very first person to have read it without just solely focusing on editing as the first effect, where with the new threads in it, right? So the fact that I got your JPEG this morning after still being unsure, because no one has ever read it with the new threads, and I had the same worry you did, because when I wrote those new threads, I was like, I'm a better writer now than when I wrote. But what I did was, in the last couple of drafts, I brought the rest of it up. You know what I mean? I kind of elevated the rest of it. And so, but I didn't know how it came off. And so when I got your JPEG this morning, in contrast with the fact that I know you're not just going to blow smoke up my ass, because you certainly didn't when you first, first read it. And it just made, now you supported me at any point. You're like, what's up? We'll self-publish this bitch. What's good? And, and I was like, no, like I want to. So I just want to thank you, man. First of all, for giving up your weekend and reading it, but helping me, because, you know, everyone says this, but it really is true in here. I couldn't have done this shit without a bunch of people. Bray's one of them. Obviously, Mama C is a huge one. She's been there every step of the way. But like you at this last, I think they closed you. Did they close you? I think they might have closed you. But listen, I love you and I appreciate you.
Yeah, man.
I wish we could talk about it more, you know what I mean? But it's really coming together. And,
well, hopefully it made you a little bit, and it'll go by a little
bit. It did.
Yeah, for sure.
It did. And we're about to submit. I'm about to give it tomorrow. I'm giving it to Maddie to smoke over. All right, we're getting mean. Right, I got to go. Okay, we got cut off. So I want to apologize because my initial instinct is to bring the viewers in and, like, lay out the whole story for them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I can't do that. because I'm pretty sure the public would go, hey, asshole, you fucking told the whole goddamn thing. That being said, I wanted to talk about it partially because I didn't necessarily even... It's the thing that was on my head and my heart just today. I just wanted to talk to you about this because this has been a long road. Mm-hmm. And of all the things I've done in prison, right, that doesn't have as much to do with representing prison and all this stuff, the clinic is by far the thing I'm most proud of, right? And it's also the thing that is least my analytical self, right? In the editing, maybe, but it's the thing I've written that is most, that was most summoned during the creation as sort of like a summoning of this thing rather than a sitting down, like, let me craft this thing real strategic.
Well, I think part of it, if you'll grant me, I think that it's a good reflection of the amount of work that you've had to do inside as a person to get to the point where you are now. I don't think that this probably would have happened had you stayed on the path that you were on when you first went down. I don't know that you would have had the faculties in order to do this. So I think it's a good reflection, like I said, of
your
growth in the work that
you've
done.
Well, one of the things I wanted to say before we got cut off is that I wish we could share more, and I hope it wasn't boring hearing, but this is a long time coming, this thing, and in a lot of ways, it's an exercise, like in this demon sense, is an exercising of this era and this time, mm-hmm. but it's also an homage to all the people that were lost, mm-hmm. that I know and didn't know with the whole opioid crisis and the stuff we've learned about Purdue Pharma and all these other corrupt things and all the pill mills and all that shit that happened. And you're absolutely right. There's no way I would have been able to write something like this. Mm-hmm. And it did feel, of all the things I've ever written, as the most divinely inspired. It's like a mission to get this thing out there as me just being the conduit for this story. And I believe that with all the stress of editing it and trying to get it out there, but also my emotional ties to it, now that we're like closing in on it and being solidified as its own entity and being pushed out and birthed out into the world, it feels like it's allowing me to kind of put that part of my life mm-hmm. to rest finally.
Sure, sure, 100%.
That whole
you got
crazy
to exercise
addiction
it out of you.
Mind state, like, right. And I know we could share as much as we would like to. And this is the type of story, too, as someone, aside from being the person who wrote it, where you nerd out about it and you want to tell everyone
Absolutely.
About the ridiculous, funny, exciting, all the shit that happens in it. So it's really tough for us. I don't know if you could hear us struggling trying to, like, not to tell.
Staring at little things, and I'm just like, don't say it. But can I will say one thing.
We should have picked out a...
Can I say fanny pack? Because that was...
Of course you can say fanny
that
pack.
That was fucking hilarious. I thought of Alan from The Hangover, like, you
okay.
can't fucking wear that thing, are you?
Oh, yeah, I forgot they do that. And then there's a time later where he says, like, look, it's useful when
yeah,
he's at
it. Exactly.
Okay, listen, they really did post it. We love you.
Yep.
And, yeah, that's it. We just wanted to add it on. And thanks to everyone who helped out. Really.
Oh, everybody.
Just everyone. So I'm going.
Sure.
I love it.
Keep on supporting. Help us out. I love you guys. And
all right.
We
Peace.
Are gone.
We gone.
Hi, everybody. Mama C here. For the complete library, full episodes, and bonus content, and mainly to support this cause, visit Notes from the Pen on Patreon. To learn more about Bobby in prison reform, visit our website, notesfromthepen.com. And follow us on Twitter to stay current. This has been another Notes from the Pen production.